what I want to do is shift from talking about development as one of the major factors that are going to shape the future of our planet, to talking about nuclear arms and their role in security or insecurity. Most people, I think, have some conception as a result of perhaps 4th of July, at least, of what explosions are like, and through extension, some idea of what a conventional bomb can do. They can blow entire buildings apart, and they do it very quickly. It's a little hard, though, to go from that to an understanding of what a nuclear weapon can do. Nuclear weapons are different in many quite profound ways from conventional weapons. And I want to kind of review those and do it in some degree in the context of the experience of Hiroshima. Carol and I have both had the opportunity to visit Hiroshima and go through the museum there. And should you ever be traveling in the... it's not working because I haven't turned this on. I was saving the battery. Now, does it work any better now? Yeah, can you hear it? Yeah, all right. If you ever have an opportunity to go to Asia, I certainly do recommend that that you go to the museum. It's a very sobering experience, but just in honor of the people that went through that whole experience, I think it's something that must not be forgotten. Well, when a nuclear weapon explodes, as that one did on August 6, 1945, early in the morning as people were going to work, the first thing that happens is there is an immense burst of gamma radiation. Gamma radiation is very energetic, extremely energetic radiation like X-rays. It will penetrate virtually anything, and when it encounters human beings, it does a lot of damage, internal damage, radioactive damage. So instantly there is a tremendous burst of gamma radiation, and anyone who is not protected by a lot of stone or something of that sort gets usually a lethal dose of gamma radiation. Also, many other things get damaged by it. In Hiroshima, in the museum, there's a stone, a large, was I think part of a doorway, in which there is a black marking on the stone, except where there's a shadow of a human being, and that blacking of the stone is from the gamma radiation. So the first thing that happens is that gamma radiation. Then something that has only recently been really fully appreciated for its significance is what's called the electromagnetic pulse. That comes next. And it comes about as a result of the gamma radiation ionizing the air. And it does so in such a way that there's a wide separation of electrons and nuclei, and in effect a current generated by separating these things. And that current in turn creates a magnetic field that is quite intense. And like the magnetic field generated by electrons moving up and down in a television antenna or radio antenna, it can send electrical magnetic pulses out into the atmosphere. And the pulses are so strong that even very short pieces of metal will have induced in them voltages that are in the thousands of volts. And it's now recognized that virtually all communications would be wiped out by this electric magnetic pulse if there were a major war. In fact, a single bomb detonated over Omaha, Nebraska, could wipe out all of the communications throughout the entire nation and parts of Canada and parts of Mexico. So that electromagnetic pulse is a very serious problem, and the degree of its seriousness was only recognized maybe 5-8 years ago, and a major effort has been made in the last few years to try to find out or find a way to allow the president to continue to have communications with the people who control nuclear weapons if there is an attack on the United States. Now, most of that work is highly classified, and I don't think anyone who has access only to unclassified literature can have a great deal of confidence at the moment that the president would continue to have communications with the nuclear forces after a nuclear war started, simply because of the destructiveness of the electromagnetic pulse. The next thing that happens after a nuclear explosion is a wave of blinding light and heat. It's called the thermal pulse. It lasts about 10 seconds, and it's sufficient to produce, with a 1 megaton bomb, it would be sufficient to produce second-degree burns, it's blisters, for about 9.5 miles from the blast. It's also quite adequate to start a lot of fires. It can produce these second-degree burns over an area of about 280 square miles. And as I said, it has a duration of for about 10 seconds. The next thing that comes along is the blast wave. And that's the one thing that is kind of similar to conventional weapons, but of course much, much stronger. For a 1 megaton weapon, it will flatten all but the very, very strongest buildings for a distance of about 4.5 miles from the site of an explosion. Finally, there is what is called the early or local fallout. That, of course, depends a great deal on the elevation of the bomb blast. If the fireball touches the surface of the earth, a lot of heavy materials are sucked up into the mushroom cloud and are distributed over a wide area. An air burst is somewhat cleaner. You don't have as much fallout. But for a ground burst with a 1 megaton bomb, about 1,000 square miles are contaminated lethally with fallout, as a rough indication of what happens. Now, at Hiroshima, the bomb that was exploded was very tiny by today's standards. It had a yield of about 12.5 kilotons, thousands of tons of TNT. Today, that would be thought of as a tactical weapon, just a relatively small weapon that would be used to take out a single city. For Hiroshima, when that bomb was set off, it was early in the morning and most people were on their way to work. The city had not been bombed at all with conventional bombs. And that there were two or three, I think three cities in Japan that were never bombed. up until the time we started using nuclear weapons. And the reason for that was that the generals wanted to have an undisturbed city that would show without any question what the destructive power of these nuclear weapons. A single airplane flew in to drop the bomb. The Enola Gay, it was called. It was name written on the airplane by the pilot in honor of his mother. And the bomb was dropped. It detonated at about 1,800 feet above the ground. That was still enough that a lot of heavy material from the earth got sucked into the fireball. The people, of course, had no idea. They did not even know of the existence of such weapons, so they had no idea of what happened. And survivors talking about the experience emphasized the suddenness of it. And people who later written scientific books about the explosion say that it is it's accurate to say that the entire city was destroyed in an instant. That the blast wave, the light, the heat, everything happened so fast that within perhaps 10 seconds at the most, the entire city was destroyed. And many people were killed instantly, but those that did survive the initial 10-second period would wake up and find themselves totally disoriented. There's stories about a girl coming, regaining consciousness and looking around and seeing no evidence of her house, no evidence of her neighbor's house, and having no idea where she was, even. And people were all totally disoriented. They couldn't find landmarks, trees, telephone poles, everything was knocked flat. It was very soon that fire started. And within about a half an hour, after the great mushroom cloud went up, there were a meteorological condition developed that's unique with nuclear weapons, and that is that it creates a firestorm. Fires start all over the place, but there's a tremendous updraft, and essentially the whole city was acting as if it were a single fire. And those who could move tried to move toward the river. And they would climb aboard barges or anything else that they could get out into the river and hope to avoid the fire. But the fire was so hot and the sun was hot and there was no drinking water. And the river, if they did drink that, was heavily contaminated with radioactive material. So that it virtually all of those people just died from loss of water and exposure to the heat and fire along the river. Another part of the experience was the burns. The radiation and the heat burns produce a unique kind of phenomena in that it burns perhaps a half an inch into the flesh. And the skin on the whole hand and the arm just begins to fall away like ragged cloth. And people you see pictures of them moving about with their skin just hanging down loose on their arms, their legs, clothes all blown away, things of about. There's a story about one of the survivors seeing a man standing there holding his eyeball in his hand. Wishing that he could do something to help this man who was obviously in intense pain. but there was nothing he could do. Another really destructive part of the Hiroshima bombing was what is called Black Rain. After the fireball takes radioactive material up, and there's a meteorological condition in which there's an intense kind of storm, very high winds, hurricane type winds, and intense rainfall. The rainfall is large drops, and the drops contain a lot of this material that's been sucked up into the atmosphere. Now, these people had no idea what it was or that it was dangerous, but the material that was coming down was some of the most radioactive material, most concentrated and most intensely radioactive that there was there. And they were hot and wanting to get cool, so many people would simply stand out in the black rain and let it fall on them. And later, doctors found people who had burn streaks down their face, and they couldn't figure out what this could have been caused by. And it was where the black rain ran down over people's faces. There were virtually no places for anyone to go. All these severely damaged, injured, burned people. And there's a book of poems that I bought at the bookstore in Hiroshima. I'm tempted to read some of these. I think that I'm not going to do it today because I can't read this poem without weeping, and we need to go on and talk about some more of this, and that will just kind of get me off the track. Yes?
Could one of those bombs wipe out a mountain?
Probably not destroy a whole mountain. It could probably do half of one. That's how we try to protect our nuclear weapons, is put them inside of mountains. But what I want to talk about now is how things have changed since 1945. And to give you a sense of what the current situation is with nuclear weapons. And to do this, I want to show you a couple of view graphs here. In this first one, I think some of you will have seen it before. It's a chart in which all of the firepower that was used in World War II, which was the equivalent of about 3 million tons of TNT, each dot on that diagram represents 3 million tons of TNT. And the one dot in the middle represents all of the firepower used in World War II. All of the other dots represent the World War II equivalents of the arsenals that we have in the world today. Now, you just look at that and you can see that it's a vast increase. It's almost an incomprehensible increase. And I have found that it's hard to look at that and really get a good feel for what's really there. So one of the ways in which I find it helpful to get this a better feel for this is to represent those dots in an acoustical way. I have here a container full of BBs, for which there's one for every one of those dots on that diagram. And I want to drop one of these BBs into this tape pan and have you hear that sound and think of that sound as representing all of the destruction that took place during World War II. Then I'm going to pour the rest of the BBs into the cake pan and let you hear the equivalent sound of all the destruction that's possible with the nuclear weapons that are in the arsenals of the world today, with each BB that falls being the equivalent of an entire World War II. And some people find it really helpful to just close their eyes and listen to this as it happens. But at any rate, here is the sound that we'll think of today as representing all of the destruction that took place in World War II. And here's the sound in World War II equivalents of the arsenals that we have today. What did you think about?
Is that just the United States has that many?
Or all over the world?
Total world arsenal.
That's global.
Gruesome is my first thought.
When will it stop?
That's the thing, I think. Will it ever stop?
Well, it's alarming. And when you think about just multiplying Hiroshima's, that in itself is a pretty alarming prospect. Because even one of those is the equivalent of many, many, many Hiroshima's. But there's, when you have that many nuclear weapons, there are things that happen that go beyond the effects of single weapons. In Hiroshima, one of the things that the survivors remarked on was how long it took for anybody to come to help them. Hiroshima is kind of in a valley, and it's a little bit separated from other cities. And the authorities simply couldn't believe that an entire city had been destroyed. And it was the best part of a day before any help really arrived. And a long time, many days, before any help of any significant proportions came. Now, if you think about a major nuclear war, the problem is going to be that every city is going to be damaged, and each city is going to be waiting for somebody to come to help, and there won't be anybody to come to help. So each city is going to be left entirely on its own. Now, another thing that happens is that with this many, with a large number of nuclear weapons dropped, there's a large amount of radioactivity that gets put way up high into the atmosphere and circulates all over the planet. And so there's a large amount of radiation that is going to be falling out for months, years to come, increasing the general level of radioactivity all over the planet. Even now, here in the United States, the amount of radiation that we receive is 4% higher than the natural background radiation as a result of atmospheric and surface tests of nuclear weapons that stopped decades ago. Another effect has to do with when you detonate large numbers of weapons this way, they don't put dust, as was in the case of Hiroshima, just up in kind of the moderately high level of the atmosphere. They put dust very far up in the atmosphere. And with this amount of potential explosive, the amount of dust and smoke and soot that could reach the upper atmosphere is very large. And as a result, it's possible to
block a large fraction of sunlight. Now, a study has been done of this problem or this prospect, and I want to show you kind of the final graph from that work. They investigated quite a number of different cases. Excuse me?
Focus.
All right. A wide number of different cases, different sized wars. Let me first explain what the scales mean. This is some time after the detonation. It goes out for about a year. These are in units of days. Up this way, we have units of temperature on the surface of the Earth. This is the ambient temperature of the Earth, you know, without any damage due to a nuclear war. This dashed line here is the freezing point of water. You can see that in all cases that they did, the temperature of the planet is depressed very far down, and many degrees. And in many of the cases, the temperature actually falls below freezing for quite long periods of time. In some of the worst cases, in fact, the whole planet would be frozen for a period of a year or more, and with very little sunlight. It's hard to really imagine what the full environmental consequences of something like that would be, but you can imagine yourself, in effect, freezing in the cold for an entire year with all of the regular life support systems of the planet essentially out of order. The city is not working, the transportation not working, the power supply is not working, the health system not working, agriculture not working, farmers not producing anything. It's on top of all of the other damage that is there. Then when it does begin to clear, another effect of nuclear war comes into effect, and that is that it destroys a lot of the ozone layer. So you would go outside and find yourself exposed to intense ultraviolet light that would sunburn your retina. You could wear dark glasses, presumably. But there may not be anybody around to provide dark glasses. And animals don't have that option. So animals would be blinded by the ultraviolet light, unable to find their food, unable to protect themselves from predators. The whole ecosystem of the planet would be substantially disrupted. Now, when you take all of these factors into account, the people who studied it carefully are persuaded that it is now within the power of human beings to destroy the whole of the human species and leave the Earth with survivors that are probably only the radiation-resistant species, certain insects and certain grasses. And it it's a you know, a serious, very sobering prospect, but one that I'm afraid is a part of the reality that we have to live with. Now, I want to stop about at this point and open it up for discussion. But first, I'll say that in the next talk that I'll give, I want to talk about what human extinction means in terms of
well, what we, I think, as Christians, as members of the church, as followers of Christ, would try to understand its meaning. And I have to say that is something I find very difficult to cope with, just to think about what it would mean for human beings not to be. But it, I'm afraid, is something that we have to think about now, and it's going to be with us as a possibility, essentially, from now on. And the reason that it will be there is that, unlike a political system, for example, a communist system or a capitalist system or whatever, in a way, a very real manifestation of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And once you have this knowledge, there's no way of getting rid of it. You think about how to get rid of nuclear weapons. You'd say, well, you can take them all apart. Well, that's true, but they could all be put back together again. Well, you could take them all apart and destroy the pieces. That's true too, but you could quickly build new pieces in the factories. Well, you could take the factories apart and destroy them. Well, true again. But as long as you know how, you can put the factories back together. Well, you could destroy the books. Well, true, but you can write more books. And people, there is no way to get rid of nuclear weapons. The fact of human existence now is that we know that we live in a creation that is made of material, that has inherent in it energy that is sufficient to destroy us. We're always going to know that, and it will be with us for as long as we survive as a species. And we're going to have to learn to live with that and know how to manage it. No other generation before us has had that knowledge or that ability, and that's what we need to, we're going to try to talk about some next time. But for now, I'd like to stop and see if you've got some questions about this presentation I made today.
We do a real service by pointing out what that force really is. It's hard to comprehend.
It is.
I was Air Force. I spent 3 years dropping bombs on various things. And I know what a conventional bomb will do. When that one dropped, I was across the ditch in Rupsi waiting to go in Japan with regular bombs. We got the news that morning, and there was not a man on our base who believed what we were told, because everybody on our base knew that that was impossible. And that took a week or 10 days, I think, before we believed that there was that kind of force in the world. It's hard to comprehend.
Yes.
Your demonstration is a pretty good one. You drop those BBs, it's enough to drive you crazy.
Yeah. Those who did survive, are they still living without any effect?
Well, they have a much higher rate of cancer. They are, many of them have scars, burns. Some of them have only recently discovered that some of the pains they had were as a result of shrapnel that was embedded in them, and people every year keep discovering more of it and getting it taken out. Probably the most, I've had dinner in Hiroshima with the chairman of the Hiroshima Society of Survivors or something like that. And he told me that the worst part for them has been the discrimination against them. that Japanese pride themselves on making a very careful investigation of a person before they hire them, before they marry. And they, it's a lifetime commitment, either in hiring or in marriage, and they don't like to take somebody that has some kind of a defect or weakness. And so it's been very difficult for the survivors of Hiroshima to get employment or to find a spouse. So they have become essentially outcasts in Japan, and that's been very difficult for them.
Then they are they subsidized by the government, Japanese government, or do they have to pay?
I think perhaps recently they've begun to get more support, but you know, right after the war, Japan was in no position to subsidize anybody. I mean, everybody was on their own. Yes.
Yeah, I keep hearing these nuclear war fighting scenarios that are being developed in the Pentagon. How realistic do people take the in the government take the fact that we can go out and fight a limited nuclear war, a controllable nuclear war?
Well, I think that's an area on which there continues to be a lot of debate. Some people feel that nuclear weapons are simply a very minor step up from conventional weapons of today. You know, conventional weapons today are nothing like what Verne used in World War II. Conventional weapons are really very sophisticated and exceedingly powerful now. And you know, people worry about the nuclear arms race, but there is a conventional arms race, and mountains of munitions that are of World War II or Korean War or Vietnam War vintage that are available to nations all over the world. I mean, there's a huge trade in these things. But some of the conventional weapons could do something quite similar to a city as was done with the nuclear bomb at Hiroshima. And so some people feel that it's only a very minor step up to use tactical nuclear weapons instead of conventional weapons. Others feel that once you go nuclear, it's inevitable that you know, it's like throwing a rock. Somebody's going to throw a bigger rock, and you're going to respond with a still bigger rock, and away it goes. And I don't know that there's any way to answer that question short of some experimentation. And I don't know anybody that wants to experiment. Yes?
One of the things that comes to my mind is I also was a bomber pilot in World War II and dropped bombs. But, and certainly nobody's happy about dropping an atomic bomb on anybody. Or nobody I know wants to make an atomic war. But you have to, what people, this may not be the place to say it, but in World War II, at the time that took place, there's nobody fighting any war knew anything about any atom bomb you read about in the paper. That's one thing.
Yeah.
Secondly, Japan, there were millions, thousands of our people going out and being killed in the Pacific, island to island, hand to hand combat. And if the people that can listen to this now could go back to that era, like we were, and have to make decisions like that, which can't be done, I realize.
Of course.
But if their brother, father, whoever was out there fighting on those islands, and Japan was given the opportunity to stop, quit, they were warned, right?
Yep.
They gave them the chance to surrender. They didn't.
Yep.
They're the ones that started the war. That's real simplistic.
Yeah.
I mean, who starts? I mean, I realize conditions start wars. I'm, you know, what I'm saying, you know. So, I'm not defending killing a bunch of innocent people, but when we drop bombs, you probably dropped on radar, did you not? Yeah. So did we. You go out for a primary target, you're not out to kill people, you're out to get rid of a ball bearing factory that hopefully nobody's in it. But if it's cloudy, you're going after a secondary target, which is dropping through the clouds on an industry, hopefully, you know, that nobody should be in, but maybe they are. See?
I think, you know, that one of the things that, I'm not sure whether this is what I would say it was a good thing. It depends on how you think about it. However, that in the past, throughout our history as humans, we have been warring. We're still doing that. One of the things that nuclear weapons has done and continues to do is to force humanity to think about what they're doing.
You bet.
And, you know, it's said, okay, if you want to continue to do this, you got the capability of destroying yourself, period. Then you should think about it a little bit better than you have.
That's right.
I hope, being from Los Alamos, one of the nuclear weapons laboratories, that certainly is one of the things that that you do think about. And I don't think, at least for me anyway, the vision isn't one of continuing to build more and more nuclear weapons, although that's my opinion, that's not a laboratory opinion, speaking for myself. So, I think that's probably maybe the next talk that we'll talk about.
Yes.
I've been listening to a lot of people, and I probably have a lot of little different things to say, but one thing that a friend of mine who's Japanese pointed out to me is that prior to Pearl Harbor, the United States was interfering with shipping in the China Sea and threatening Japanese warships and Japanese commerce in the China Sea prior to Pearl Harbor. But another thing is that I'm not so concerned about Russia or some other nuclear power using the force of nuclear weapons, because I believe those who have nuclear forces understand the threat not only to themselves by using it, but what concerns me is since the cat's out of the bag and these weapons are somewhat available, I think it's important to understand that terrorists could also use these weapons, and we have a pretty free country, which would make us pretty vulnerable, and Europe also be very vulnerable to that kind of threat. And yet at the same time, we're still being pretty adventurous around the world with our military in different parts of the world and frustrating other people. And that's what concerns me about nuclear weapons.
There are at least two people in this room who could build a nuclear weapon. And there are hundreds of thousands of people around the world who could build one.
Yeah, I could make a comment on that. It's very clear, at least over the past 6 years, people that I know in different countries, that they have developed a theoretical understanding of nuclear weapons. Countries like Spain and West Germany and France already has them. But many countries that don't have them now, so they're developing the capabilities for them. So,
yes.
I really think that that's some sort not that a lot of people can build them, but there's people here in this room that can build them, but to say that I'm not worried about ourselves, and that I frankly worry a lot about Ronald Reagan having this control over nuclear weapons, or any other leader. And I think that if the leaders of the world really understood the destruction that can be wrought by the dropping of one nuclear bomb, I can't imagine anybody wanting to build one. I think that there's a complete lack of understanding of what that really means for the world, or a denial. Maybe the understanding is there on some level, but I think that there's a denial of that. And I'm just as worried about Ronald Reagan as I am the Ayatollah of Israel.
Some of the other women have something that they'd like to ask. Here's one.
Yeah. One of the first questions was about how the survivors are doing. What about their offspring? Is there any information on, are there any genetic problems that they're experiencing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they have a much higher rate of miscarriages and birth defects than anybody else. Yeah,
so these are long-term effects?
You bet they are.
We don't even know. Yeah.
Second generation?
Second generation, I imagine it's less, but I don't know what it is. Did you have a question?
No, I was pointing at her.
There, yeah.
Do you have any personal thoughts about how inevitable the use of these weapons are going to be? I know some scholars and thinkers, such as maybe Carl Sagan, he doesn't talk about if this planet is destroyed. He talks about when this planet is destroyed. And do you have any personal thoughts on that yourself?
Well, there is a certain probability that something will happen. And there are a lot of different weapons, and maybe some of them would be used, maybe a whole lot of them would be used. It's a little hard to tell. There is in existence a really complicated set of radars and computers and rockets and nuclear explosives and timers and one sets in the Soviet Union, one sets over here. And these things interact as a result of leaked radio frequency emissions and spies and various other things. So there's very incomplete information on both sides about how the two things work. It's balanced and intended to remain stable and not to react until such times as it's told to react. It's intended to be so destructive that neither side would be tempted to use it. The both sides are trying to minimize the reaction time because they know that there's only something like 23 minutes between the time a launch would be made and when they would have to respond. It's a very short period of time. So it's in a lot of ways inherently unstable. We've talked about terrorists. I don't think this is any kind of secret, but one of the things that I worry about, and I think a lot of other people do, is somebody getting some material, some plutonium, uranium, 235, and putting together a crude bomb that maybe doesn't have any more yield than the one used in Hiroshima. Now, the materials that you need, the timing devices, the lenses of explosive lenses are much more widely available now than they were then. You had to build them all from scratch at that time. But suppose you put one of those things together and put it in the back of a beat-up old VW bus and drive it up to the fence surrounding one of our missile silos. Set it off.
And what happens then? Does the Pentagon say, my God, the Soviets are here, and we better launch? Or have they got sophisticated enough ways of telling that, you know, that's some prankster at work there? And I don't know, but it would sure rattle a lot of cages if something like that happened.
When I every once in a while on business, I drive from Los Angeles to San Diego, and I go right by San Onofre Power Plant, which is maybe 1,000 yards from the freeway. And if that power plant happened to melt down due to somebody doing something, I'd take out all of Southern California for a couple thousand years.
Yeah, nuclear power is another problem, yes.
Yesterday you were commenting on the inefficiency of the government computers with regard to the Global 2000 report. Can you make any comparison about the computer sophistication that's supposedly guarding this weapon system and the other government computers? Are they equally untrustworthy?
I think we really want to know.
Well, I've never seen those computer systems, but any computer system I've ever seen has got problems. And you know, one of the things we all have to worry about a great deal now are these computer viruses. Those things are really pernicious, and once they get installed, and some of them you can't detect for years afterward. And I just think that they have an enormous potential for kind of unbalancing this jerry-rigged system that we've got. So I think there's an enormous problem there, particularly when you think about the Star Wars stuff and the possibility of developing software to run that. Just boggles the mind to think about how that could work with no opportunity ever to really test it all out.
What's the terminology? Computer virus? I'm not familiar with the phrase.
Well, computer viruses are generally very short little programs that go in and replace a part of the operating system, and once they're activated, they replicate themselves many times over, you know, well, maybe four or five times, and maybe they don't do anything at all until they've been activated, until command has been transferred to them for several times. Then they may simply wipe out all your files. Or they may go in and store garbage in every other storage location. Or they may print something funny on your screen. Or they may change the target locations of all your weapon systems. They're very hard to detect. Yeah. Well, it is 5 o'clock, and I think we should adjourn. If there are any other questions, I'll be glad to stay around and talk a little while.